what do you need to thrive? And the answers became the 24 demands of what we call Justice Resolution 001. The city council, the mayor, went into negotiations with those of us who occupied the zone then and there. We've had multiple rounds of negotiations with varying degrees of success. I was in 4 hours yesterday in negotiations because what we know is this city did wrong. The first words of Justice Resolution 001 is, whereas the city killed a man. They know what they did. They know
Absolutely.
They did wrong. They know they didn't have the moral authority to open the streets because injustice closed those streets. And until they make justice, they didn't have the authority to open it, which is why they commissioned a group of African Americans to attempt to do it. But the real question remains now. If I don't leave my front porch where I am right now, as I'm staring at my barricade, if I'm not there to make sure it stays safe and secure and sustainable and sacred.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including assistant producer Romero Funes and today's audio engineer. I'd also like to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org. And follow us on Facebook,
You're tuned
Twitter,
in
and
to
Instagram.
Listener-supported community radio.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Now stay tuned for Fortress on a Hill.
Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that. You good
people. Tom Secker, welcome back to Fortress on a Hill.
Thanks for having me back, man. I mean, it's been a little while since we spoke last. The last one was Platoon, wasn't it?
I believe so, yeah. Show. I think the last one we talked about was Platoon.
So, yeah, great to be talking to you again, as always.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here. So today we're going to talk about the third film in Oliver Stone's Vietnam trilogy, Heaven and Earth. It is a pretty big step away from traditional American war movies, and even from Platoon and Born on the 4th of July in some ways. And I think it was, you know, it was done really well, and I think that the like we were talking about before we started recording, you know, to give a full arc of someone's character to see them as a young person, where they come from, up through, you know, all the various stages of becoming an adult, and especially to understand what it means when war is a unrequested dance partner in that person's life. And it also gives us with Platoon, we saw, you know, Chris Taylor beginning to end of his deployment there on the ground in Vietnam. And then with Born on the 4th of July, we had Ron's arc from it had a couple scenes as a kid, didn't it? But most of it was, you know, late teenager through the convention, the Democratic National Convention that they showed it in, if mm-hmm. I remember correctly.
Yeah. I mean, this one is more like Born on the 4th of July, but it's sort of even bigger
yeah.
in terms of the scope of the central character's life. Born on the 4th basically starts with him being about 17. I think, like you say, there are a couple of childhood scenes, but I don't remember them, so they clearly didn't have that much impact. And we see him from there through to, I'm not sure how many years after he returns from Vietnam.
It didn't seem like it was very long.
It's not that many, clearly. Yeah, it's not like this is a 15, 20 year arc that he goes on. Whereas in Heaven and Earth, it's, I don't know, 40 years of her life, almost? Something like that.
Covered. It's quite intensive.
There's a lot in there. There's an awful lot that happens in this movie. For a film that isn't at all really action-based and isn't even that fast-paced,
no,
it manages to cram so much of this woman's life onto the screen. I think that was probably my overriding impression, just from a kind of film craft point of view, is that it was clearly an incredibly ambitious screenplay to try to tell so much story in one movie. It's like 2 hours. It's not even that long a movie.
Yeah.
It's like there's enough story in there for a 12 episode TV season, probably more than enough, to be honest, that they could have, you know, you could stretch it out that far, and I don't think it would seem thin. And I don't want to say it's the best of the three Vietnam films. I mean, I guess Stone has actually made more than three Vietnam films, since most of his films are ultimately in some way about the Vietnam War. But the trilogy, the sort of recognized Stone Vietnam trilogy. I wouldn't say it's the best one. I'd say some aspects of it are the best out of those three. They're all terrific movies. I found this one wonderfully metaphysical, for one thing, and just very, very touching. I mean, the other two are emotional films, powerful films. They didn't kind of touch me emotionally as deeply as this one did. That would be my basic kind of first impressions of it, overall impressions of it.
Yeah, there was a kind of catharsis that came across in this one that the other two, I assume by design, did not have. And just to get started with it, I really enjoyed the fact that the story went back as far as, I think it was 1953, mm-hmm. When the French first came to Vietnam. And in terms of us understanding, you know, the full historical arc, that I don't know that most people could tell you that the French were there before American advisors arrived in the, you know, late 50s, early 60s. Mm-hmm. And to understand what happens to a region, both the people that live there and the environment, and what war does to it. In looking over my notes last night, I was thinking about the there's a Bedouin groupings of Iraqis that used to populate southern Iraq. And because of the waterways that they were able to grow crops in have all been destroyed between American bombings and going after oil and all the other wonderful things that American occupation bring to a place like Iraq. But I was trying to think about the before, And it's not often in a war film that you see a genuine before. This was before anyone came. It's such a beautiful place, you know, such a neat place. And that it also begins with her and her family discussing about their connections to the land through their ancestors, which is something else that is I don't want to say it's not American, but it's not common for Americans to have that point of view. You know, modern Americans don't take the long look in terms of what their ancestors did, what they contributed, didn't contribute, anything like that. So it was really refreshing to see that, to see them make those kind of connections, and that is something that we miss as Americans, is that Western viewpoint that there were things here before. You know, there were however many million Native Americans in the United States before American settler colonialism kicked in and all these people got killed or forced out.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
Oh, it's the same. I mean, perhaps going back even further, it's the same coming from a major European power. I mean, people in this country don't feel that kind of attachment to the land for various reasons, obviously. But I guess we only feel it as a kind of collective nationalistic thing, that there is still a fair amount of, like, proud to be British and, you know, Britain's sort of important and special and we're the British and therefore we're important and special.
Yeah.
All of that, but it's only really through that mechanism that we feel that attachment to our ancestry and our past. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of, like, nostalgic yearning for the empire, and there again it's sort of, well, everywhere that was part of the British Empire existed a long time before we turned up.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those places had all kinds of stuff going on that we in fact wrecked. And other places perhaps weren't very developed, and I mean, there's some positive, obviously, consequences of the British Empire. I think the negative consequences massively outweigh them. But yeah, it's still that very much that sort of not even the white man's burden, more like they're lucky to have us. They're lucky that we have been colonized by a people as great as the British. There is a, you know, that idea is still about, but it's all funneled into nationalism and militarism. It isn't like about being proud of our culture or proud of our language or, you know, any of the actual good things about Britain. It's all the worst aspects that kind of emotion is inspired by and then funneled into. And yeah, it's lovely to have a film that takes such a long view and such a broad view, but also that has a real kind of emotional and, as I say, metaphysical depth to it.
Mm-hmm.
That there is meaning for these people in this land. It's not just a place to live and, you know, grow food and all the rest of it. It's something much more profound than that, whether it be a religious thing or a familial ancestry thing or a whole bunch of other stuff. You know, all of the above ultimately is implied at one point in the movie. And yeah, so unusual for an American film, or even a British film for that matter, to even acknowledge any of that stuff, let alone make it a core part of the story and of the protagonist's arc.
I also loved that the lead character in the film was a woman. You can't find very many war films that have female leads of any kind. And especially ones that are not Caucasian, that are not the white leads, the American or the British ones. And I was reading through some of the reviews last night, just kind of wanted to see what other people said, and the consensus was that that the main character arc wasn't as good as Platoon or Born on the 4th of July. And I thought, does that have anything to do with, because she's a woman and because mm-hmm. the roles in society and the roles in warfare are, that this film, this story diverges from them in such a major way. Because I didn't notice any of that. I don't know about you, but I didn't feel like that the arc of it was less powerful. It is certainly, you know, it is much more comprehensive and delves into a bit more interpersonal stuff, I think, but but that didn't make it any less powerful to me. And I wondered if the reason that, because it was a female lead, that male reviewers would not be as inclined to see this person as a battlefield equal, if we want to call it that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an element of that in those sorts of negative comments about the story arc, or at least the protagonist's arc, because so much of it is told in small moments, especially the segment after she gets to America. A lot of this is like dinner table stuff. Mm-hmm. It's very profound and important, and it's all, you know, signifying something much greater and bigger than what's actually going on domestically, but it's told through that sort of scene. Whereas most of what happens in, say, Born on the 4th of July is very high drama. It's kind of high drama from start to finish, whereas mm-hmm. Heaven and Earth tells it in much more smaller moments that in themselves, a lot of them aren't that dramatic. So I think there's probably an element of that too. But yeah, of course, it's that, you know, when you have a central character, they're not only telling a story from a perspective that you either haven't seen before or certainly haven't seen very much of before, but also through a character that isn't the sort of character you expect to see be the anchor for a film like this. I mean, I can understand, just as a sort of natural instinct, people aren't going to feel as much for her as they do for Tom Cruise in Ron in Born on the 4th of July, or, you know, Charlie Sheen's character in Platoon. Because it's not so immediately apparent to them why this matters and why they should care just as much about this story, if not more so, than the previous Oliver Stone stories. But I had the opposite reaction. I think the actress is absolutely wonderful. I found her totally captivating at almost every moment of this film. Not just in a sort of, you know, man watching a woman kind of a way, but you know, in a much more deep way than that. I cared about this character. I wanted her to succeed. I wanted things to get better for her. I wanted to see these things, you know, her life get better and her overcome these demons. And I certainly felt that in the other two movies, but not quite the same extent, because I don't think they got into the emotional side quite as explicitly. This is a much more feminine film. It sort of wears its emotions on its sleeve more, I think. And yeah, I mean, when this film came out, I'm guessing 98% of film reviewers were white men, and they're just not as likely, even though we're sitting here two white guys saying the exact opposite, but you know, it's just not what they were expecting. And a lot of, especially film reviewers who probably watch three films a day and review all of them, they're used to stereotypes, they're used to simplicity. This is not a simple film. This has layers and complexity beyond what almost any other American film of the last sort of my lifetime has actually managed to accomplish. There's probably a handful of others that I'm not thinking of, but this is right up there. And layers of emotional complexity. It's not like geopolitics. This isn't a thriller. This isn't where, you know, it's a complex plot that's a social commentary or something. This is more about a person's actual lived experience. And so that's harder to immediately grab hold of and understand the significance of. So I think they've kind of just missed the point, to be honest.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So around the time that the French came to Lili's village, which her family home ended up getting burned to the ground, and it was kind of an initial salvo for her in understanding war. And you know, you could see a lot of confusion in her trying to understand why this happened. And then it carried on a bit to later when the Viet Cong actually arrived in her village and gathered everybody together and explained, there's this war coming, we want you to be on our side of it. And you could see in her dad's face almost all you needed to know about his experience with it, because he was already at that place of understanding what war meant and what it could mean to the people that he loved. And you know, there was some confusion with Lelai in looking at her dad. Why was he doing this, you know, or what was paining him so greatly? But that goes back into that generational experience, you know, that the, you know, that their culture was very steeped in tradition, understanding one's ancestors, and that the lessons of that, the lessons of what had happened in 53 with the French. I want to say that there was, prior to that, there was a Chinese occupation that happened adjacent to World War II, or it may have been the Japanese. I can't remember. But anyways, it was a place where a lot of war had happened over a very long period of time. But just seeing her old man come to terms with that and come to terms with understanding the death and destruction that may be coming, it was really really powerful to me. And then
yeah, I did like the kind of contrast in that moment between, or that little sequence between, her confusion and his sort of, it's not quite steely resolve in a, you know, typical American sense, but yeah, he seems to grasp it, that the shock of what's just happened might only be the opening salvo, or just the latest salvo in an ongoing, you know, series of invasions of their home. But yeah, that he's in some way a mirror to her experience.
Yeah,
that because he has, like you say, this much greater wisdom of a knowledge of just how many times this has happened and how easy it is in some ways for this to happen. And thus he kind of processes the shock. That's not quite what I'm trying to say. That he appreciates, he feels the pain of what has happened, but that he can't in any way give in to it because he knows it's probably coming again.
Yeah.
And of course that is exactly what then happens. And we all know, watching this film, I doubt there's anyone who's watched this film who isn't at least somewhat familiar with the Vietnam War, and you know that at least that happened. They know it's coming again. We're watching this, we all know.
Yeah,
his prediction, his sort of intuition is going to come true. And that's what I mean about the metaphysical side of it, that he has no particular rational reason, he has no immediate evidence for believing that, but he's damn right.
Yeah,
and we know he is. And that kind of connection between the audience and a secondary character like that, it really helps create a degree of compassion and a degree of empathy for what these people are going through, that because we can feel this, that his intuition is going to come true, because we know it ultimately did, it's much easier for us to basically put ourselves in his shoes, to actually feel something and understand something of what that must have been like to go through. And that kind of connection with someone who, let's face it, most of us will never meet that person. Most of us will probably never know anything about those people who went through that in a sort of first-hand direct experience way. So again, just as Platoon and Born on the 4th of July managed to build some bridges of compassion and managed to actually move that dialogue about the Vietnam War forward and helped, you know, actually do something with all of that grief and pain, that was constructive and in some way beautiful, or at least very honest. This film manages it, but manages it with Vietnamese protagonists. Yeah. And that's not easy to do. That's... Oh, my phone keeps going off. Sorry, I'll mute it. That really impressed me. Because it's not necessarily something I would normally buy into, or I certainly wouldn't buy into it if it was done in a shallow tokenistic way, whereas this film does it with such depth that I did buy into it and actually was like I say, just really rooting for these people.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. Yeah, it's I would love to be able to tell a story like this in the shoes of Iraqis, in the shoes of people under the American occupation, and to have those same kind of sentiments, those you know, their own connection to their surroundings and trying to make sense of it, because they also have the long arc of war between between everything that happened there, the Iraq-Iran war, Persian Gulf war, our sanctions, all that stuff. But so next we move into Lelai's relationship with both the Viet Cong and the newly arrived South Vietnamese military. And it very clearly shows how difficult it is for her to attempt to balance that. That, you know, I don't know what I would say, that she seemed like she had a greater connection to the VC there, but that it was because her brother had joined up with them. There was a lot of tied up emotion for her in how they behaved, what they did, is my brother going to be okay, and knowing that these are the guys that come in the night, you know, these are the guys that aren't going to just walk up on a patrol to your home. You know, they're people that know your village, know your who you are, and although they didn't give any clear-cut understanding about it, about where loyalties lie, because she saw her teacher get murdered by the South Vietnamese, according to them, for being a VC sympathizer, or was it teaching them on the VC's behalf, something like that. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, just to jump in on what you're saying here, yeah, I very much felt that sequence was a little bit confusing, in as much as she clearly does have some kind of mixed loyalties here, and she clearly does have some kind of internal conflict as to quite where she positions herself in the midst of all of these different factions. But there again, that's something that's so wonderful about this movie, is that you get to see several waves of people, different people, coming to this village, mostly bringing a fair amount of chaos and violence with them in one form or another, from all sorts of different angles. So you very much get the sense of, you know, this is just some, you know, little place that's caught in the crossfire between all of these different factions struggling for control, or whatever it is that they're trying to do and trying to achieve. So naturally she would have some degree of split loyalties and confusion about this. So even though I found that part of the film a bit confusing, I think that was the entire point.
Yes.
We're not quite supposed to, you know, this isn't a simple story of you're supposed to be on this side rather than that side. You're basically on her side.
Yeah.
But even her side, because she's somewhat confused and divided on it. Yeah, that's where you end up. So again, it's about, you know, building that compassionate bond between a protagonist and an audience, so that they actually understand something of what that must have been like. It's very well done. Very well done.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciated that they did, you know, make it confusing, that it was, you know, that the to understand, to actually have to be physically stuck between two actual armies, between two entirely different groups of actual soldiers, who, like you said, the only prominent thing that they bring is death and destruction. You know, that's not what they say, but that is definitely what they do. And I really liked her there's a little, just a little bit later, she started having nightmares about her brother being thrown from a helicopter. And there was a comment that she made about the that the ant in the anthill never moves up. They only move further in terms of that the, you know, that that their chosen loyalty to the VC, you know, we may see it as you know, this person that clearly has sympathies with the VC, but could it also just simply be because they live and work right there beside them, that there is, you know, that that because there are members of it that are within the community but may not be shouting to the rooftops about their affiliation, that you know, informant on informant, that they, you know, they really know what's going on, but there's no chance for them to get into a position of authority or leadership, that if they try to become a bigger part of it, they just bury themselves deeper. There's just the quicksand becomes that much worse in those in mm-hmm. those moments.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So then she is arrested and tortured, brutally raped by some of the VC soldiers there, which to me came across as just the most giant of betrayals because of the things that she had done on behalf of the VC, that that she had tried really hard to attempt to be in their good graces, if for no other reason than to protect herself and protect her family. And then she gets arrested and raped, and then the worst thing of it all is that she is exiled from her village, that because they consider her to be an informer of some form and function, that she can't be there anymore. And unlike, you know, a typical Western point of view, you know, her village is her entire world. That's where she's lived her entire life. It's where the spirits of her ancestors live. That being ripped away from that is almost it's almost a social womb of sorts, of the, you know, in the bosom of her family, if we want to coin it that way. And that was really hard to see. That was really hard to watch her go through that. And, you know, carrying all these different traumas between her treatment from the VC after working on their behalf, to the VC being the ones that tell her she's disloyal and kick her out of the village. But I would say that was one of the first big betrayals that she goes through in a film filled with betrayals of different kinds.
And in some ways, her being exiled from the village is actually worse than what happens to her before that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, fucking bad enough, for sure. But it's then followed with this. Yeah, you're basically talking about, a pretty, I don't want to say a simple girl, but a girl with very little, very limited life experience, mm-hmm. but at the same time, a very serious bond to her family and her village and the land around it and all of that. That is in some way the worst crime against her at this point in the movie. Or at least that's certainly something that touched me very deeply, that, like you, I had quite a, you know, strong response to that. It's kind of just kind of terrible.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
On the other hand, it does lead to my favorite part of the movie, so I guess I can live with it, but. Yeah.
What was that? What was your favorite part of the movie?
Well, the next sequence where, you know, she's forced to move to the city, and she has to adapt, and we get to see her intelligence and certainly her sense of humor really start shining through.
In
that piece, I found myself laughing at her quite a lot. There's something. I don't know why this is. There is something I find quite amusing when I hear women swear really bluntly, and the number of people that she tells to fuck off in that next sort of section of the story is pretty high, and it's all in every moment entirely appropriate. It's the appropriate response because it's like there's various men harassing her and people trying to steal her money and all the rest of it. And yeah, that's after the suffering of that first. I mean, this isn't a three act story, it's more like a five act story. The suffering in that first act, it was very gratifying to see her, you know, okay, she's forced into this position where she has to take more control of her life and she has to now make all these decisions for herself. But seeing her do that was great. I just really, really enjoy that part of a story where someone is struggling but actually manages to overcome quite a lot of those obstacles. The stuff that she overcomes in this movie is extraordinary. And again, I just found, like I keep saying, I found myself rooting for her all the time.
There was one little piece I wanted to talk about with that. I don't want to call it a mansion, but the people that her mom and her were working for just prior to her becoming homeless, before she has to start selling stuff to GIs and learning the power of fuck off, as with American GIs, which it's generally all you need to know. You just tell them to fuck off, and most of them fuck off. But that she had slept with the master of the house, which I aside from what happened to her with the VC, and not that's a sexual experience that someone should
I know what you're saying.
Certainly it's certainly not a good thing, but it is something that she went through. But in terms of the first time that she willingly had sex with somebody else, and you can see that, you know, that relationship between her and the master, it was very, very short, but in terms of that, there was a bit of safety there, a bit of familiarity. And then she finds the very hard place to be after the missus of the house finds out that she's been sleeping with her husband. And her mom, in trying to convince the missus to let them stay there, offers Lelai to become a second wife to this man. And you see in her face, in Lelai's face, just this horrible state of betrayal in doing that. Now, and I understand what the mom's place was in trying to do that. She was trying to give her daughter a safe place to be, you know, that they had talked about, that it was a nicer place and they had decent food, and that they, you know, it wasn't a horrible place to be. But in mom offering that for Lelai, there's that horrible betrayal, but at the same time, the mom is trying to protect her kid. She's trying to give her what she sees is the best situation from that. And then she's completely cut off. She's already been exiled from the village, but at that point, she gets cut off from all of her family from back in the village. I don't remember where mom goes at that point. I think she goes back to
Hawaii.
What?
Nor do I. I think she goes back to the village.
That's what I thought. And so, you know, she ends up living intermittently with her sister, who is working as a prostitute there in Saigon. And she's trying to sell stuff, just trying to make do. Going through the base garbage, trying to find food to eat, trying to find things to sell. And then she ends up moving into that whole realm, you know, telling GIs to fuck off, because all of them want to have sex with her. And then there are the ones that, it's not that they won't take no for an answer, but they try seven or eight more times, thinking that she's just trying to get more money, when the reality is she doesn't want to. Doesn't want to at all. Then it comes to that two GIs offer her $400 to have sex with them, which then for what she was going through was an astronomical amount of money. It's just, I mean, it's especially from being homeless and everything. And you see her really, you know, burden herself with that, that, you know, is that $400 would really, really help her. At this point, she has a kid, has a little boy, and is trying to figure out what to do. And although it doesn't, it doesn't connect directly, this kind of brings me back to, you know, her issues of being with the VC, you know, and dealing with them in the Southern Vietnamese Army, that in terms of finding a happy medium spot, you know, how close do I get to these people? How close do I get to those people? Can I really trust any of them versus I need to eat, my kid needs to eat. You know, I'm sure lots of the guys that worked on bases that I lived on in Iraq did not want to work there, but that where was the other work going to come from? Mm-hmm. You know, in war, especially in those times, other than, you know, and you have to pick your poison. You know, I can work for this army, I can work for that army. But the people around you start to respond to that and you have to live with it. Okay, I'll shut up for a minute so you can talk.
No, sure. I mean, that's, I think, one of the reasons, aside from what I've already said about that, this segment of the film and this segment of the story, the other thing that I really, really love about it is the sense of pragmatism that everyone, not everyone, most of the people in this situation are trying to find the least worst thing to do. Mm-hmm. like with her mother appealing to the, you know, mm-hmm. the master of the house's wife and all of that. Again, it's not that her mother is in any way evil. She is you know, you understand what she's trying to do and why. And even if you think I wouldn't have done that in that situation or whatever, doesn't really matter. It's again, it's this much more feminine approach to storytelling where it's more about understanding why people do the things they do and what's important to them. Mm-hmm. And that carries throughout this whole section. It's not just the practical, pragmatic challenge of, you know, I've got to, like you say, I've got to feed myself, I've got to feed my kid and everything, but also the challenge of, I guess, figuring out what it is that she really wants in this situation, because she's up to that point kind of just been parachuted into this. Mm-hmm. Most of the major things that have happened were not her fault and weren't of her choosing. And then, like you say, you get this situation with the two GIs offering her this extraordinary amount of money to prostitute herself, essentially. And yeah, what choice would you make in that situation? It's very difficult to know. It's kind of impossible to know until you're actually in it, I guess. And that sense really came through, that, you know, that very down-to-earth human sense of, well, you can't pick and choose the situation around you. You can only pick and choose your own responses to it and which opportunities or whatever come your way you actually try and pursue. And again, I really sympathized with her throughout all of this, but also enjoyed watching someone go through that maturing and that realization that, you know, her choices really matter. Mm-hmm. and that she has some, because up until that point she doesn't really have that many choices. And that's, yeah, I just had a great affection for that part of the movie, not just because it made me laugh, but because it's something I think we've all found ourselves in that at some point in our life. Not quite like what she had to go through, but something akin to that, of where you realize you're in a fairly desperate situation of some kind or another, whether it be financial, emotional, whatever. But that you do ultimately have some degree of choice and you have some degree of power no matter how much chaos is surrounding you. And yeah, it's just sort of a beautiful thing, a beautiful story to tell because of that, because it's about things that it's not just about the Vietnam War at all. It's about so much more than that, and things that I think almost anyone, certainly beyond the age of like 30 or something, possibly even younger, would be able to relate to this. And, you know, it's by far the least successful of Oliver Stone's Vietnam films. Hardly anyone has seen this film in relative terms. And like I say, in some ways, it's the best of the bunch. So I hope, I guess where I'm really going with this is also that I hope that anyone who hasn't already seen Heaven and Earth or hasn't seen it in a long time, like I haven't before I rewatched it so that we could have this conversation, go back and give it a rewatch. There is so much in this movie that's great, and there is so much in it that is provocative and will hopefully bring out the best in you. Because that's, I know I keep mentioning the word compassion, but that's what this film is. It's an extremely compassionate film. And if it helps inspire the people watching it to be more compassionate, then that's a bloody good thing.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. Absolutely. Absolutely. We have far, far too many war films that compassion is, at best, a faraway secondary character, if it's mentioned at all. And I think that they should create more films like this, especially to understand the cyclical nature of war and what it does to people over multiple generations. So the next big thing in the story is Steve. And Steve is he's a E6 Marine. Who's stationed near Saigon or near Saigon. And I'm trying to remember, I want to say they saw each other on the street first, and then he like tracked her down later, and had to find out where she was at. And there's this really long, I don't know if we want to call it a courtship, but a period where she doesn't really want anything to do with him. She believes that he's, you know, just another GI, that he probably wants sex and nothing else. And Steve goes out of his way to demonstrate that he's genuine, that what you see is what you get, that he cares for her son. And you can see her trying to, you know, that her fighting that impulse of wanting to put any trust into him. You know, she's gotten to this place where she is, you know, she's kind of protecting herself and her son, but it's a very tight circle, and there isn't room for Steve in it. And he, you know, he really demonstrates that to her over time. And one exchange that they had that was really powerful to me, and we've already touched on it a little bit, but that she mentions about that Americans don't care about their ancestors, that they don't care what they do to the world. Now, Americans, historically speaking, we have a very tight, rigorous, ranked ancestry that most Americans cling to, you know, our founding myths and such. But they don't come full circle in understanding not just what those men said, but what they really did, you know, their actual lived lives and the destruction that came with that. And Steve, like me, when I joined the Army, like I'm sure like many people when they join the military, that's the ancestry, if we want to call it that, that they carry with them. But they don't carry with them, you know, being deployed to Iraq, they don't carry with them what the U.S. military has done there over the last 50 to 70 years, which absolutely, you know, should fit into that history. But you see this very clear contrast between the two of them. And you know, Steve does have some good redeeming qualities, but he doesn't look at life in that same way that she does. He doesn't have the long view of understanding those things. He tells her very specifically that he's looking for an Oriental wife. That is the reason. I mean, he cares for her. He shows her that and stuff, but that is his ultimate goal.
Hmm.
Then we come to the evacuation of Saigon towards the end of the war, that there's just chaos everywhere. Steve told her that her and her son were on a list to be able to access one of the bases to be able to get a ride home. He finds them in Saigon and actually physically puts them on a helicopter, and tells it, you know, it was, like I said, it was absolute chaos there in terms of the initial American pullout from Vietnam. But he puts them on this helicopter and tells it to leave. He's still on the ground, you know, there's not room for him on the bird, and he says, you get, I'll come and I'll find you later. And then he's listed as missing in action. So there's a period there where she's not sure if he's even still alive. And that whole area, that whole section of the film really nails down the desperation that's happening for people in that time, wanting to be able to get safe, especially if, you know, that now for Li Lai being the partner of an American GI, that the North Vietnamese or the VC will not look kindly on her if they happen to find her.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about that part, Tom?
Well, again, it's a bit like the village in the opening act of the film. Is she's very much caught in the crossfire of all of this, and. I mean, I don't know. The sequence with the helicopter, I mean, I don't know whether this actually happened in reality, did feel... I guess it only felt a little bit hackneyed to me because I've seen it so many times.
Mm-hmm.
Not because inherently there's anything actually wrong with that, you know, little piece of the story. And that's a tiny little gripe in an otherwise outstanding, amazing film. again, it's the way this film manages, because one of the cliches that's said in reviews about this movie is it tells a story about the Vietnam War from the Vietnamese perspective. I'm sure you've stumbled across this phrase
in
some reviews you saw, and I'm thinking that's not what this film is really doing, because there is no one Vietnamese perspective.
No.
And the film does brilliantly at showing you that in fact the Vietnamese people were divided in so many different ways. And okay, it's largely told through the story of one woman's perspective, but it is also a film where, like you say with Steve, he is actually quite charming and likable, especially in this part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a funny scene between the two of them where she keeps telling him to leave and he doesn't. But he doesn't do so in a sort of like aggressive, nasty way. He's just I'm wooing you. I'm not just going to give up, kind of a way, which is quite likable. I mean, I'm not sure if I would actually approve of that sort of behavior, but whatever. In terms of the film, it makes you like him, or at least understand where he's coming from. And that's what I think the real strength of this movie is not it's telling you it from a so-called Vietnamese perspective. It's that it's pointing out there are so many different perspectives here, and a degree of understanding and compassion of all of them would actually help all of us heal somewhat
in
terms of coming to terms with this total disaster of a war. And that applies to everyone. That applies to Steve. It applies to our protagonist. It applies to her family. You know, everyone in this film ultimately kind of suffers to some extent. And all of them have some degree of scars or grief or whatever it may be. And that's ultimately what the film is trying to achieve, is not tell you a story from a particular perspective, but make you aware of all the different perspectives and why actually you should care for all of these people to some extent. except, you know, obviously the bastards, you know, the VC who rape her. I mean, I don't really give a shit about them, but pretty much everyone else in this film, I can to some extent see where they're coming from and why they're doing what they're doing. And I think that's such a strong thing and such an unusual thing, especially in a war movie. Because in a war movie, it's like sometimes you'll get, you know, critics praising something. Oh, it tells both sides. And it's like there isn't only two sides to this damn thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, can we not have a bit more imagination, and can our compassion not extend a bit beyond simple binary thinking or some crap like that? And I know this is one of the problems of film reviewers. They talk in cliches because they're watching a lot of cliched movies. But yeah, again, I just think those reviewers who said that missed the point spectacularly. This film has so much more to offer than that. And this segment where those two were, you know, falling in love and then are ripped apart really tells that, really brings that home.
I think that, you know, that it's also about, you know, our we're so entitled when it comes to how many different viewpoints are told in a war film, a Western war film, and that you know, that we can make movies that are in, you know, so much on the DOD side that they, you know, provide literal support and get to actually change the script. And we haven't got to that that part of talking about the concept of soul debt in the movie, but that it essentially could be understood as what we now think of as moral injury in some way. If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode, please visit our website at www.fortressonahill.com. We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, facebook.com/FortressOnAHill, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify, and now KBOO.FM. You name it, just about anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for